Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
While Americans debate a $15 per hour minimum wage, there are fast food workers in Denmark earning $20 an hour. And that's just the tip of the Nordic iceberg. The Scandinavian countries have larger social safety nets and higher taxes, yet they have job markets as strong or stronger than ours, and more people expressing satisfaction with their work and their lives. How'd they manage it? Could we follow their example? Well, in Viking Economics, sociologist and activist George Lakey studies how the Scandinavians got it right and how we can, too. Viking Economics is published by Melville House, and I'm very pleased to have brought George Lakey to our show today. Hello.
Thanks.
Which countries have Viking economies? Just the Scandinavian countries, or do others like Germany or Holland?
It's most fully realized up there in the Nordic area, and therefore economists call it the Nordic model. But there are certainly things in common that are held by some other countries, but especially, and I call it Viking economics because I especially thought it would be interesting to trace the cultural background. So Iceland and Norway and Sweden and Denmark all have Viking ancestors. I thought that would be fun.
But not Finland.
No, Finland actually ethnically comes from the Magyar people who are related actually to the Hungarians as well. So on the other hand, when economists talk about the Nordic model, they do include Finland.
Because it has similarities to their neighbors?
Very much, very similar.
Which measures are they doing better than the United States?
Well, for one thing, they don't let the market go out of control. They think that the market is a useful and flexible instrument as long as it's supervised in such a way as to keep benefiting the common good.
So government regulation is not an issue in these countries?
Oh, no. It's totally assumed that people count on it, in fact, because they know that a market run awry means disaster for people in general.
What about things like homelessness or poverty or crime?
They think poverty is so 19th century. Like, why would a modern industrial economy put up with poverty? There's just no reason for it. So what they did was rolled up their sleeves and pretty much abolished poverty, not through just one measure, but through multiplicity of measures.
Even when new immigrants are coming into the country?
That is a challenge, and it's especially a challenge been taken on by Sweden more than the others, although Norway to some degree as well. And so you will see, for example, I just checked the unemployment figures again today, the latest ones, and you will see that Sweden has more of a struggle absorbing the immigration. In fact, they absorbed more Syrians than any other country per capita during this latest flood of immigration from the Middle East. And so what we can expect is an economy that struggles for a bit. They had to close their doors because they were overwhelmed. But they're willing to do that struggling. The majority of Swedes say, no, hospitality is important. We have to accept this.
But we are talking about homogeneous societies.
Not anymore. That's certainly historically the case. But now, one in seven Norwegians is from out of Norway. That's true in Sweden as well. Not as many people from out of Denmark. But nevertheless, there's been quite a change. It used to be just all these blue-eyed blondes when I first went to Norway when I was a young man. And now, I'm walking down the street and I hear people walking behind me, chattering away in fluent Norwegian. And I turn around expecting to see blonde and blue-eyed, and there they are in dark skin with people from Africa and all kinds of places.
Is it a coincidence that the state whose people probably have the closest ties to Scandinavia, Minnesota, remain in many ways more progressive than their neighbors in the Midwest?
That's particularly striking in North Dakota, which had a tremendous Norwegian concentration. They actually created a state bank, the State Bank of North Dakota, which then protected the North Dakotans from the kind of problem that most of the rest of us had in the United States after 2008. The state of North Dakota has distinguished itself for its stability, and they also have treated their oil extraction in the same way as Norway has. So I would say the strongest influence has been felt in North Dakota.
But not everything is rosy. Doesn't Iceland have one of the highest rates of alcoholism in the world?
Alcoholism is definitely a problem in the northern climes. It's very depressing, I can tell you, having lived through a winter in Norway. When you're losing the sun, all the people who are affected by seasonally affected disorder are really hurting, and they tend to turn to alcohol. So, and you'll find it, though. You'll even find a difference between southern Norway and northern Norway. Beyond the Arctic Circle, people in the summertime, they are giddy and laughing and partying all the time. But in the winter, it's a pretty morose kind of place. So, but it's a problem in that way in Russia, in all the northern climes.
Mm-hmm. I'd imagine in Alaska as well.
Yes, that's my I'm told that.
The U.S. has higher per capita GDP. Isn't GDP the standard gauge for comparing economic performance internationally?
It's a gross one. I'm glad it's called gross because because it doesn't take into account the distribution internally so that you can have a very high GNP and also high poverty at the same time. The Nordic approach is to go for equality, income equality. And so in the various international ratings that are published, they score the highest for equality. So those are very prosperous countries, but they share their prosperity rather than let it be gobbled up by their economic elite.
In the aftermath of the financial crisis, the Great Recession, and the failure of mainstream economists to anticipate either, are social scientists considering new measures to evaluate economic health?
The most radical one and controversial one is the happiness index.
But that's in Asia.
Well, no.
Isn't that in Nepal?
There is an Asian country. That's right, Nepal. That scores very, very high on that. And Ladakh does very well on that. But the Nordics do very well on that as well. It's of course, a composite index. The nature of an index, it's a composite of factors. But and it, as I say, remains a bit controversial, but it's fun to think of people, even though they do have the challenge of their spot near the Arctic Circle, that they end up being reported by outsiders, by these folks who compile the index, as the happiest people.
Yeah. My guest is George Lakey, L-A-K-E-Y. His book, Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. Globalization, offshoring, outsourcing, deindustrialization have been blamed for stagnant wages in the United States. What effect have they had in Scandinavian countries?
Those countries have always been living in a globalized world, actually, when you stop to think about it, because they're small countries and they've been dependent on the sale of raw materials, especially Sweden, Norway, and Iceland. For Iceland, what is the global market in fish? You know, that's going to determine how they do. In Norway, the global market on fish, but also on logging, because logging has been a major product.
What about oil, which has...
Now oil. That's
but,
right.
But oil has been in decline. Has that affected the Norwegian economy?
No, because they are diverse enough. And actually, oil is I think, often exaggerated by Americans in giving credit to the prosperity over there, because Sweden and Iceland and Denmark don't have oil, and Denmark has a little bit, but they're all doing very well compared with the U.S. But Norway does have a particular abundance and had to figure out how are we going to deal with this abundance in such a way that it doesn't run away with our with inflation.
How do they compare with Germany, which is the top performer in Europe?
Top performer in some ways, but not with regard to what I call the indicators of well-being. That is, indicators like health, indicators like ability to for young people to steer their own course in life. It's striking to me that, for example, Norwegians have more individual freedom than Americans do, and more individual freedom than Germans do in the way in the choices that they can make. The society's been set up in the Nordic countries in such a way as to maximize the freedom of choice for young people and middle-aged people. Let's say middle-aged people get tired of their careers and wish that they could strike out on their own as an entrepreneur. Well, Norway has per capita more entrepreneurs than the United States does. They generate more startups than the U.S. does because they really support their entrepreneurs. They support people getting out of dead-end jobs or jobs that they perceive to be dead-end and doing something different.
On the other hand, as I understand it, if you go to art school in most of these countries, you will get support for a while. You can get
That's right.
studio and all of that. And yet we aren't seeing too many great artists coming out of these countries.
Well, they're very tiny populations, of course. And they do have that historic difficulty of being so homogenous because actually creativity is on the side of diversity. This is something that I think is now pretty broadly accepted, that diversity promotes innovation. It's actually been one of the glories of the United States. I love that about our country, that it has such a history of diversity. And then we've been enormously creative, jazz and all the things that we've contributed to the world stage. And that's because of our diversity. Well, the Nordics are late catching up on diversity. And so, on the other hand, the Swedes outdo the United States on patents. So there are areas of creativity and innovation where they still set a very high standard.
Have you seen debate or anger over politics and the economy of the kinds of things we see here, especially during this election?
They have done so. That is, they had enormous polarization a century ago, because a century ago it was basically the majority versus the economic elite. And so the polarization became very great. And in the 20s and 30s in a country like Norway, you had a span going from the communists on the left, the hardline communists on the left, to the Nazis on the right. There was a Nazi party. And there were Nazis in Sweden as well. So they had a broader kind of polarity than we did.
And during World War II, Denmark and Norway were in the Nazi German orbit.
That's right. That's right. They were occupied, and the homegrown Nazis were very pleased about that. So that they've gone through tremendous polarization. Now they're very unpolarized. Now their political spectrum, it has enormous agreement, a kind of consensus politics. And the reason for that is because they went through this massive change. The polarization brings, you know, the opportunity for change. They went through tremendous conflict. The majority of people ganged up against the economic elite, which had been leading the country historically, and basically fired the management. They basically said to the 1%, you're just not doing well. You could do way better, but you're not willing to, and therefore we're taking over and we're creating democracy here.
On the other hand, after many of the elections in the North, newspapers in America are filled with stories about how we're seeing a change. The leftist government has been voted out of power. Conservatives have come in. There's a whole new wave of political thinking in
right.
Scandinavia.
I'm so glad you raised that question, because this is a problem of how our journalism gets a bit skewed by our own environment. So I've interviewed widely different people, and that included the head of the leading conservative think tank in Scandinavia, a Norwegian conservative party member. And I was talking with her about a range of things, and she said, you know, I just back from Washington, and it got me thinking again about your President Obama, and I'm just so impressed with him, and I really think that he would fit very well in the Conservative Party in Norway, because our spectrum is such that we conservatives are really about where your leftish Democrats are, and then our spectrum moves left from there. And so I would love for your president to join the Conservative Party. So when American journalists notice that the parties that call themselves left over there lose their majority and the parliament is taken by the so-called right wing. Their so-called right wing is actually what we would call left Democrats.
My guest is George Lakey, author of a number of different books and articles. The most recent, the one we are discussing, Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. It is published by Melville House, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with George Lakey, whose most recent book is Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too, published by Melville Books. Is there a Nordic model for an economy, ways of doing things that we could follow in this country for better results? First of all these countries have parliamentary governments, so that means that there's probably less of the kind of partisan divide that we have here.
Well, that wasn't the case before they had this mass movement that the different countries had that that forced a major change. That is, back in the day, they did have parliament, and they did have parties that bitterly disagreed with each other and fought tooth and nail, and stalemates happened. And then it was the economic elite that would decide what they would do anyway, and so they would. It was a kind of. Sometimes people say when I give talks about this, well, that's a little bit like here where we have an apparent Congress and debate and so on, but it ends up that the economic elite are deciding what we do anyway. And so they had a similar situation, I think, a century ago, and that's why it was so important for them to dig in at a grassroots level and build a movement that could make a power shift. But and in that regard, I think Parliament isn't different from Congress. On the other hand, in the detailed way it is, because parliaments do support coalition among multiple parties, and that's not what we have. We have the two-party system, and that. On the other hand, for the people who feel that they are not represented by the two-party system, then they feel very out in the cold, whereas in the parliamentary system, of course, they can have a party representing them.
Well, there's the other part of the parliamentary system. The leader of the government is a member of the majority party. In the United States right now, we have a situation where the president is, Congress is dominated by the opposition party. So that leads to all sorts of conflicts.
That's right. And stalemate, right? Kind of.
If you don't like it in a parliamentary situation, you vote out the party in power and you just have another party in power.
So it is easier to go to the polls, back to the polls, and get the election called again in the parliamentary system. That's an advantage.
The economist John Roemer and others have argued that we need to develop social ethos, a path leading to a society where people value solidarity and community more. Do Scandinavians already share something of that social ethos?
Yes, they do. And I think they experience it more fully than we do. And I think that has to do with their historical homogeneity. That is, because we have been so riven by the system of slavery and how long that endured, and then the legacy that still divides us, we have a harder time for white people, for example, to feel a real sense of empathy and solidarity with people of color. And so that is a problem. And one of the things that I'm excited about today's current as compared with earlier years is I think more white people are taking responsibility for our side of that. I'm white myself, are taking more responsibility for that and saying, hey, it's about time we move past this and remedy it. The problem, of course, is that we can't really get past it unless we address the economic situation as well. And that's one reason why my book is published now, because it's so current both to our racial justice challenge as well as to our economic justice challenge.
None of the Scandinavian countries use the euro as their currency, unless you count Finland. Have they benefited from staying out of the eurozone?
Very
and was that noted in the British Brexit campaign?
Yes, it was really characteristic. I mean, they split down the middle on the EU joining, actually. Iceland and Norway stayed out of the EU. Sweden and Denmark joined the EU. But when Sweden and Denmark joined the EU, they held out for their own currency, and they won.
Similar to what Britain had
they
done.
Won. That's right.
But are they resisting the EU in the same way that the British did? Feel that the EU sometimes lays down too many rules that they're uncomfortable with?
Exactly. So there is internal tension within Sweden and Denmark about the fact that they're members, but on the other hand, they're members, and that's not going to change. I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. What was really surprising was that Norway refused to join the EU, and they refused because they felt that the bureaucracy and the lack of democracy would get in their way. And your earlier question about the currency, it has definitely paid off for Sweden and Denmark to have their own currency because it gives them wiggle room. And so when the austerity decision was, you know, came down from on high in the EU that we're going to punish countries for the failures of their bankers, that the Swedes and Danes both could hold out for the retention of their own monetary system.
Which, of course, didn't happen with Greece.
No. Greece was a sitting duck.
Social scientists talk about Nordic models in economics, foreign policy, education, welfare. Are you looking at one of those Nordic models or all of them? How similar are they?
I'm interested in all of them. The book is pretty holistic in that way, but I think one of the most striking things for and hard things for Americans to picture is that with regard to welfare, the Nordic countries had, before their big shift that happened in the 40s and 50s, they had tried welfare as a way of handling poverty, and they found that it didn't work. That is, means testing, trying to develop specific programs that would be targeted toward poor people, they found didn't work, weren't effective. And so they actually shifted. So in a way, it's a misnomer to call them welfare states because what they gave up was welfare in the American sense, and instead they've substituted universal services. So what that looks like in the United States is Social Security. Social Security is a universal service. Everybody gets Social Security, no matter what their income was when they had working lives. The same with Medicare, and those universal systems. In fact, those are Nordic design principles that we've already adopted in our country and have been working pretty well. And one reason why the universal programs work so much better than the anti-poverty programs is that everybody has a stake. So, for example, when on the far right of our country there's been an effort to do away with Social Security or to hand it over to Wall Street, which in effect I think would be giving it away, there's been fierce resistance across the board. Middle-class people as well as working-class people have resisted that.
And including a lot of conservative Republicans.
Exactly, exactly. Because it is a universal system. Whereas it's very easy to cut food stamps or to cut any program that's designed for the poor because it doesn't have as broad political appeal. So the Nordics actually were able to abolish poverty partly because they gave up welfare. Welfare, I'm saying it in the American sense of welfare. They gave that up and substituted for it universal services. So everyone goes to university for free. Everyone goes to college for free. Everyone goes to trade school for free. Everyone gets into apprenticeship programs for free. And everyone gets health care for free.
But not everyone is competent as everyone else. And I'd imagine some people do well in a job and others don't do well in a job. What happens if you're one of those people who just can't hold your own? Doesn't that often lead to poverty?
It's such a great question. I asked that very question at a research institute in Oslo. I said, what about that? And they said that their attitude is that work is a fundamental way in which people participate in a society. And therefore, everybody who is at all able to work and they're within working age, you know, should really be given all-out assistance to do that. And they told me about a kind of story that goes the rounds in Oslo between a social worker on the one hand and a labor office person on the other, in which the social worker is saying, look, There's nothing we can do with Ola. You know, he's a drunk. He's been a drunk for 20 years, and he goes on these binges, and there's no way we can get him a job. And the labor person will say, you mean he's drunk all the time? And the social worker says, well, no, he's not. You know, he goes on this binge for the weekend, and then it takes Monday, you know, and to sober up, and by Tuesday, but then he goes on another binge on Friday, and that's it for him. So he's obviously not a candidate for the workforce. And the labor person says, well, then go find him a job. In fact, I will find him a job that will employ him on Wednesday and Thursday morning. And because we must put Ola to work, because Ola deserves the chance to participate in his society and not be a drifter. That's the kind of conversation that goes on. Very, very strong work imperative. And for that reason, more people are in the labor force in Norway than in the United States, where
there's no unemployment.
Oh, there is unemployment, but it's very, very low. And the reason for that, in fact, they have to, at the moment, they have 50,000 guest workers from Poland to fill in holes because they are generating so many jobs, and they take meticulous attention at supporting people to find. Now, of course, some people say, I can't work because they're a round peg in a square hole, right? But if you've got the assistance of people saying, let's keep trying until you find the square hole that will, or the round hole that will work for you, then there's way better chance that you will actually be able to hold a job.
George Lakey is my guest. His book, Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. It's published by Melville House. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. All of this is paid for by very high tax rates. And there are people in this country who claim that we pay the most taxes in the world, although I think I read some statistic that indicates that we're actually 47th highest in the world. But people don't mind paying those taxes. In the end, you work really hard. You should be able to keep the money you earn.
Except that then you wouldn't get the benefits that you get. You know, my dad used to tell me when I was a boy and learning to be a consumer, George, you get what you pay for. Meaning, don't just pick up something shoddy because it seems cheap, because we do get the value of what we pay for. Well, that is their attitude toward taxes. So, in fact, Inc. magazine sent a journalist over to Norway to interview the highest paying tax people, entrepreneurs, millionaires, and so on, and ask them, how do you feel about these incredible taxes that you pay? 50% is an average, and Norway also taxes wealth at the rate of usually 1% of people's wealth. So in addition to paying income taxes, if they're wealthy, they're also paying a wealth tax. And so this journalist said, well, how do you feel about paying these high taxes? And that was the answer. He got my dad's answer over and over. People said, well, hey, we get what we pay for. We get stability. We get a phenomenal country to live in. We get all kinds of free things. Like, I don't have to worry about whether my kid is going to go to university. I don't have to put money aside for that. I don't have to worry about my dad getting a terrible cancer and having to mortgage the house for that. We get so much for our taxes, we're happy to pay high taxes.
But a common view is that higher taxes are a disincentive to innovation. Higher government spending crowds out private investment.
It's just not true. Empirically, it's simply not true. There's, as I said, there's more startups over there than there are here. Innovation at a very high rate. In fact, worker productivity is higher there than here. So this is actually a very big philosophical difference that goes with the Nordic model. It was Gunnar Myrdal who won a Nobel Economics Prize for this theory, an alternative to the classical economic theory, which is you have to have punishment hanging over people's head in order to get them to work. And he said, it's just the opposite. It's human nature to want to work. By the way, Sigmund Freud made the same observation. It's human nature that has us working. The question is, do we get to do meaningful work? And are we justly compensated for the work that we do? And people will be happy to work. And the results are statistically very clear. Higher productivity there than here, despite the fact that we have a sword hanging over us.
On the other hand, the United States is a major driver, arguably the major driver of the world economy. And New York City alone has a larger economy than the combined economies of Sweden, Norway, and Denmark. even though they have two times as many people as New York City. So we're talking, are we comparing apples and oranges here?
In a way, because you're not taking an account of the resource base. One of the miracles that I get into in the book of the Nordic achievement is how far they came with relatively fewer resources than the U.S. The U.S. not only has an amazing abundance, and historically it's phenomenal abundance in our country, but also has derived tremendous benefit from Latin America and other countries that we've been able to control and extract from. So the U.S. becomes then a center of accumulation, which enables it. And I'm not denying the productivity that's been here, and certainly not the innovation that's been here, which, as I say, is supported by our diversity. Nevertheless, when you take the resource base into account, and also the fact that we've had an enormous internal market, which economists believe is a tremendous help to the economic development. And the Nordic countries have had tiny markets. And I mean, Iceland's 320,000 people. And so what is the size of Buffalo? So when you have the advantages that the U.S. has, then it should be a world driver. And when you have the disadvantages of the Nordic model, it excites my curiosity all the more to know, well, how is it that they are able to accomplish what they accomplish?
If differences in outlook, attitude, or philosophy account for a lot of the Scandinavian difference, what could Americans do to adopt some features of the Scandinavian system and still accept it as American?
Well, we already have adopted some. For example, we used to have in New York City a free university, right? And the U.S. has had a fling with free higher education, and it's tragic, actually, that we gave that up. There's absolutely no reason why we shouldn't have that.
It was paid for by taxes.
Yes, of course, because there's enormous economic benefit. In fact, you'll enjoy the story of the first when I enrolled in the University of Oslo in Norway, and I paid my $14 matriculation fee, and then I checked twice. You know, I thought, well, surely there's more money you're wanting from me. And they said, no, this is it. And I turned to some Norwegian friends I was making at the time, other students, and I said, how does it make any sense that university is free? I don't come from a country where that's true. And they said, look, George, wouldn't you say that brain power is an economic resource for a country? I said, yes, of course. Well, he said, then why would you want to short-circuit the economic resource of the country by making it contingent on parental income? You'd want to fully develop the economic resource called brain power, and that's what we do, and that's why it works so well here. And I thought, whoa, talk about pragmatic. Those people are so sensible. So that's one of the specific things. We made a start with free universities in some places. We can return to that, pick up where we left off, and advance it far more than we have.
Can any of us go now to Oslo or Stockholm and go and enter a university?
Yes, indeed. You're welcome to go.
But I'd have to learn how to speak the language.
Well, it's not that hard to learn. I'm not much of a linguist, but I did learn Norwegian.
George Lakey, his book, Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. It's published by Melville House. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for your great questions. Enjoyed it.
Laura Bates says that the tipping point for her came after a particularly difficult week filled with several harassment incidents, from being catcalled on the street one evening to being groped on the bus the next. Those experiences led her to create the Everyday Sexism Project in 2012 in an effort, as she writes, to talk about sexism, equality, and women's rights in a modern society that perceives itself to have achieved gender equality. Through Twitter and her website, she collected experiences from over 80,000 women and men around the world, and now her book, Everyday Sexism, looks at why normalized sexism affects women's equal participation in society and argues that women should not tolerate it. It's published by Thomas Dunn Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought Laura Bates to our show. And we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. Have you experienced casual sexism at work, with friends? Have you been catcalled on the street? How do you react? And how did it make you feel? can give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Laura, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
How do you define casual or normalized sexism?
Well, I use the term every day when I set the project up for two reasons, really. Partly because this really is impacting on women's lives on a daily basis, and partly because it has become so normalized in our society that we don't really even notice it anymore. So I think I would define it as something that goes unnoticed, unchecked, uncommented on. And because of that, it becomes very difficult to challenge. Because if you challenge something that everybody else is just sort of letting go by, then you're the one who is seen as the prude, as being uptight, as making a fuss about nothing. And I wanted to try and challenge that perception that much of sexism is just normal and it's just the way things are.
Why do people often react to complaints of sexism with phrases like, stop making a fuss, you're overreacting, you need to learn to take a compliment or a joke?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's so common. I think there are two reasons. I think the first reason is that normalization. If you live in a society where it is just normal to be walking down the street and to hear someone shouting at a woman, making a comment that's explicit about her body, if we live in a society where for girls, by the time they're 16, almost all of them have experienced a guy either exposing himself in front of them on the subway or rubbing himself up behind them, touching them on the bus, then you grow up in a world that teaches you this is just normal. And all of that helps to contribute to that idea that someone that speaks out is then being difficult. But I think it also comes from the idea that people see these as isolated incidents. So usually the person who says it's just a compliment, stop making a fuss, is somebody who hasn't experienced this themselves. It's usually a man who perhaps hasn't experienced this or witnessed it. And so he's seeing it through this completely different lens of this one-off experience and doesn't necessarily recognize the cumulative impact of all of these incidents together, or indeed how the kind of wider structural gender imbalance around us in our society can impact on those smaller incidents.
A listener, Danielle, on Twitter just wrote in to say, when have I not experienced casual sexism? But it's also being dismissed as political correctness. Even liberal comedians in this country have complained about the way college audiences have reacted to sexist jokes.
Yeah, I think we're seeing a really fascinating time at the moment because there is this really great wave of feminism. There are women all over the world and all over the US who are standing up to this, who are challenging it. And particularly on college campuses, you're seeing this incredible revolution led by young women, led by survivors. And I think that makes people very uncomfortable. It makes people scared that they're being accused of something. It makes people concerned about that kind of issues around freedom of speech and political correctness. And that's really interesting. I saw a fantastic experiment this morning, actually, that someone had shared on Facebook, where they had programmed their browser to replace the term political correctness in headlines with treating other people with respect. And it generated some hilarious headlines, you know, treating other people with respect will lead to the end of the world, says, Donald Trump or whoever it was. And I thought that was quite nice because I think this is something that is often seen as a threat, but in reality is just about people asking to be treated as human beings, essentially.
Is it often a case where women are so accustomed to gender-based prejudice that it sometimes fails to even register with them?
Yes, I think that can definitely be true. One of the fascinating things when I set the project up was that I started by just going to women and girls and saying, have you ever experienced sexism? And it was this fascinating effect where you could be standing in a circle of women and several of them would say, oh, no, I haven't. I've never experienced sexism. And you'd say that's wonderful. And then another woman would say, well, on my way here today, a guy in the subway sort of said, all right, darling, smile. And I was clearly reading my book and he wouldn't take no for an answer. And all these other women would look up and say, oh, well, yeah, that's happened to me. And then another woman would say, well, you know, I was in the office and I was about to present at a meeting when somebody from the head office walked in and looked me up and down and said, oh, I'll have coffee with two sugars, please. And then the other women said, well, yeah, I mean, I've had that kind of situation over time. So I think there's certainly a sense of normalization that it becomes so tiring and so ingrained. And the response is so difficult when you do react that many women do just get used to kind of putting up with it.
Do you think it's generational? Estelle from Brooklyn wrote to our show page, the times I was the object of predatory males, I froze like a deer in the headlights. And now that I'm 73, I look back with horror and chagrin at what I tolerated. I explain this to my granddaughter, hoping that she'll be able to extricate herself from situations that I couldn't when I was young.
Well, you know, I think it's so sad. We hear these stories from women of different generations saying how horrified they are to see their children and grandchildren experiencing what they went through and saying, why hasn't anything changed? I think that certainly this is something that is affecting very young girls. What's horrifying is that many of our stories are from girls in their school uniform when this first starts to happen to them. So I don't think it's dying out, but I would definitely say that we hear from so many women who make that comment, I froze. I always thought that I would fight back. I blame myself. Why didn't I say anything? And I think it's so important to say that that is a completely natural and normal reaction. We know that the body freezes in situations of perceived threat. We know that there's a panic. And really, I think all of us are trained into looking at the victim in these circumstances. What did she do? How did you react? How do women cope with this? And we very rarely ask, let's stop this happening in the first place. How could we do that? Why are men doing this? We don't educate men. We don't say we should be talking to our grandsons and our sons about respecting women. And I think it's time that we flip that around.
I'm speaking with Laura Bates, who writes regularly for The Guardian, The Independent, New Statesman, Time magazine. Her book, Everyday Sexism, the project that inspired a worldwide movement, is published by St. Martin's Griffin in the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And we're going to take some calls. But before we take those calls, a reminder that people sometimes say things that you can't say on the air. So could you please be careful with your language when you're reporting on experiences that you've had? Natalie from Montclair, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. So one experience I had is in Montclair, I was walking down the street with my dad, and someone just called out the window to my dad and said, your girl has a nice butt, with a worse language. And it was just like, I don't know, like it was so awkward. And like, I'm very vocal in how much I hate catcalling, and I'm very loud in my feminism, and like, I'm just like, if people catcall me, like, I just like, I will stop and stare them down and like,
well, how did your father react?
He looked down and was silent, and then said, he just like said very quietly, like, that wasn't very nice. And like, I was like, nope, it's not. It happens every day. Enjoy it.
Laura, you want to respond to that? Because often part of the story is how the male who's witnessing this also responds.
That's true, and probably that must be a really horrible situation to witness it happening to someone that you know and care about. For many men that we hear from, actually, that's a really eye-opening experience, because it does often happen when you're on your own. It very often happens in isolated scenarios, so that can be a real moment for men. And I'm sure that that conversation of hearing his daughter say, this happens to me every day, will have been really, really shocking. It's in a horrible way, it is one way to kind of open men's eyes to it. And when people say, you know, don't make a fuss, it's not that big a deal, you do sometimes think, well, can you imagine this happening to your daughter, to your mother, to your loved one? We shouldn't have to say that, because we shouldn't have to humanize women to men by imagining if they were an appendage of theirs. But, you know, I think that is really powerful, and I'm so sorry that happened.
I just heard a report in which it was just the kind of harassment we're talking about, the catcalls, were put into two separate categories. One, a bunch of guys sitting around. The catcalls there were seen as more like a peer thing, guys with each other. And then there's an individual catcall when you're walking down the street and somebody says something about your butt or says to your father that your daughter has a nice butt?
Well, I think that that's really interesting because I do think it's a much more varied problem than we tend to think of when we discuss something like catcalling. We think of it as one sort of issue, but it can be really varied. We know, for example, that for women of color and LGBT people, it's often escalated. They're more likely to experience it. They're more likely to experience threats and escalations of the violence. We also know that women who try to reject it find that it escalates, that if somebody has the audacity to say, actually, my body isn't yours to comment on in a public space, that they often then see violence as a result. And I know two women in the U.S. have been killed in recent years, one shot dead in Detroit and one had her throat slashed in Queens because they simply rejected the advances of street harassers. So I think it is really important to say that this is something that takes many forms. And while it's often dismissed as harmless or just a compliment, I think that those situations really belie the fact that it is about power and it's about control and it's about a public space and carving out roles within that public space for who is in control and whose body is there as an object for others. And that's why it's really important that we challenge this within the broader spectrum, I think, of gender-based violence.
Didn't you receive threats after you put your Everyday Sexism Project site up?
I did, and it's interesting because it's a very simple website. It just asks people to share their experiences of witnessing or experiencing any kind of gender inequality, and we receive submissions from people of all genders and welcome those. It doesn't exclude men. It never for a second set out to vilify all men. It was very much about saying this is a problem that affects all of us. It disproportionately affects women, we know that, but it also, sexism is bad for men. It tells men that they can't talk about their emotions, that they can't cry, that they can't be involved in raising their children. This is about everybody. It's about people standing up to prejudice, not about men against women. And so I was quite shocked at the level of the vitriol that from within a couple of weeks of starting the project, I was receiving and still receive on a daily basis death threats, rape threats, long emails from people describing which 7 knives they will use to disembowel me with and what order they'll do it in. I mean, just incredibly graphic and very, very scary. And I think, sadly, we are moving into a period where I don't know a single woman working in this area who hasn't experienced that kind of abuse.
And what do you think is driving that kind of anger, that level of anger? Do you think the men are feeling threatened? Are they defending their privilege? Or is it just that you can do that kind of thing online? You couldn't do it in the past?
Well, I think that we do live in a world in which the message is sent very clearly that the way to silence women is through violence. I mean, we know that 1 in 4 women in the U.S. experiences domestic violence. This is an epidemic. This is a massive problem in our society. And we do send that message to men. If you want a woman to shut up, you hit her or you threaten to hit her. And I think we're seeing that spilling over online. But I think that the root of it is perhaps a sense of panic. I think when you talk about gender equality, it's very difficult for some people to get past the idea that in order to be talking about rectifying something for women, holding women up, supporting women, you must be taking something away from men. And I think that that leads to some very scared, knee-jerk reactions of, I just don't want this to happen. I just don't want to have this conversation. I can't cope with the implication that there's something wrong that I might have done or that I might have benefited from this in some way. And so the response there is as a knee-jerk reaction to try and shut the conversation down by silencing women in the way that people best know how.
Where were the stories you were receiving on the Everyday Sexism Project coming from? All over the world?
They've come from all over the world. We have a very large number from the United States, about 20,000 from the U.S. They've come from people of all different ages, different races and ethnicities, disabled and non-disabled, religious and non-religious. It's incredible when you look at the spread. It ranges from a woman in an office being told to sit on her boss's lap if she wants her Christmas bonus, to a church reverend constantly being asked if there's a man available to perform the wedding or the funeral, to a dad being congratulated for babysitting his own children, to a 13-year-old girl who's been told by her own family family that she shouldn't talk about her rape because she was wearing a short skirt and she brought it on herself, to an 80-year-old woman who writes, I have too many stories to say in this small box. Here are some highlights arranged by decade. And really from all around, so from a woman in Mexico whose university lecturer told her, Caidita, te ves más bonita, you look prettier when you shut up. From an Asian woman who was on campus with her university boyfriend in the UK when people started shouting at him asking if she was a male or a bride, or a disabled woman who was asked to do a pole dance around her walking stick, or a transgender woman being hounded from a public bathroom. They're incredibly varied, and I think they really demonstrate that intersection of different kinds of prejudice as well, and how we have to be tackling this alongside racism and homophobia and disablism at the same time.
Have you heard in Britain that the American Bar Association declared it professional misconduct to discriminate against or harass opposing counsel, or anyone for that matter, in the course of practicing law? You can't call your opposing counsel honey or dear.
I have heard that, and I think that, you know, that might seem like something that's relatively small. It's the kind of exactly the kind of thing that we would get people complaining about, saying, oh, for goodness sake, that's ridiculous. But if you think about it, a courtroom is the perfect example of an atmosphere where those kind of very, very small gendered slights can have a real impact. If you have a jury sitting there listening to evidence being made from both sides, and they have a prosecution and a defense lawyer, and one of those lawyers is female and is being constantly undermined by being called sweetie and darling or honey or whatever it is, that's very important in a situation where they are making up their minds depending on which of those persons they trust the most. So I think that's a great example of why this stuff does matter, and the impact can be so much bigger than perhaps the initial perceived problem.
My guest is Laura Bates. Her book, Everyday Sexism, is published by St. Martin's Press Griffin in the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. We will continue our conversation. Take a lot of calls, by the way. All of our lines are full, but our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate, or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is @LeonardLopate. We'll be back right after this. And we are back with Laura Bates, her book, Everyday Sexism, the project that inspired a worldwide movement. It is published by St. Martin's Griffin in the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. And we have a lot of calls. We try to get to as many of them as we can, starting with Lacey from the Upper West Side. Hi, you're on the air. The Upper East Side, I'm sorry.
Yes.
I moved you across town.
You did mention schoolgirls talking about how they get harassed. I grew up in New York City. I went to a private school with uniforms. Taking the subway in the morning was literally a battlefield. I wore shorts under my skirt because I was touched all the time. It got so bad that our school actually brought in a policewoman to speak to us about getting groped on the subway. And basically what she told us was to get off, to mention it to a train conductor, and to really not do anything about it. And I kind of, you know, looking back on it, it's been 10 years. And if I had a daughter that happened to, I mean, I would tell her to yell it out in the subway, that if you're in a schoolgirl uniform and you're getting groped by someone on the train, I would hope that other people would come to your defense.
She could also stomp on his foot, don't you think?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, there were things that I did in high school, but I never felt safe.
Now, let's talk about that for a moment. We mentioned earlier witnesses. If somebody witnesses mm-hmm. that kind of sexism, you're on the subway, should you get involved? People are often afraid to get involved because the groper can be seen as threatening.
Well, I think it depends on the situation. I think that obviously every situation is different, and I would never say that there is a one-size-fits-all approach. Of course, personal safety has to come first. But I think that actually in a subway type situation where there are lots of people around, where it's often well lit, that is often a situation where people are able to step in. And I would really encourage this line of conversation, that we talk about what witnesses can do. If you see this, you should say something, you should step in, because it is much easier in that situation as a witness to step in and say something than it is as a terrified 14-year-old schoolgirl with some strange man's hand on you in that moment to think of what to say, to do anything. You know, we cannot be expecting victims to be the ones to resolve these situations. But what we have to do is send the message to the person doing it that they will not get away with it and that it is socially abhorrent. Because for me, that's the real clue. And I think this is partly because you mentioned that when I set the project up, I was groped on a bus that week. And what happened was that a man sat next to me and he put his hands and on my leg. And then before I knew what was happening, he had run his hand up my leg and grabbed my crotch. And I moved away from him and said very loudly on the bus, "This man just groped me." I was on the phone to my mum at the time. So I was telling her, "I'm on the bus. This man has just groped me." And everybody on the bus looked out of the window. Mm. Nobody stepped in. Nobody said a word. And it sent two really powerful messages that day. It sent me the message as a young woman, this is your problem. You deal with this. This is life. No one is reacting. This is not remarkable. But it also sent him the message, this is fine. You can get away with this. You go on and do this again. Because even when someone says what's happening, people aren't even remotely bothered. And I think that that's what we have to change. That's where this normalization comes from. People not responding, not helping.
A listener on Twitter, I don't know if it's a man or a woman, feels that there's a difference between whistling at women on the subway and actually touching them.
Yeah, I think that's true. This is a spectrum of behavior. We are talking about a continuum here, and it starts with the verbal advances, the unwanted comments on someone's appearance, which I think implicitly is what a wolf whistle really is. And yes, if somebody is groping you, if somebody is touching between your legs or grabbing your breast or stroking your legs, that is actually a form of sexual assault, at least under UK law. But I think what I would say is that while, of course, they are different and no one is saying that they are the same thing or have necessarily the same impact, I would also say that I believe they are connected. I believe that it is the same power imbalance behind both. I believe that if we turn a blind eye to wolf whistling, if we say, actually, it's not that big a deal if you just comment on a woman's breast, then we are opening a doorway that leads to that kind of normalization that suggests, well, maybe I'll just touch them one day as well. And I think that we have to say at some point, enough is enough. Women are people. We're not going to treat them as second-class citizens anymore in any way.
Chuck from Suffolk County, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Apropos the topic right on right now, back in the early 70s, I was walking in the Lower East Side with a fellow college student, and someone walked by and inappropriately touched her. And when she told me, I turned around, the guy was already long gone, and I didn't see anything. And it was such a frustrating and embarrassing situation that I had nothing I could do to protect my friend. And I wasn't about to go chasing after him and start a fist fight because it wasn't up to that level, but it's still something that bothers me to this day.
I'm so sorry to hear that. I think in that situation, the very fact that you were there and that you presumably signaled to your friend that you were shocked and frustrated and supported her, while it sounds very simple, does make a difference, because we hear from thousands of women who experience this kind of thing or worse. And when they tell someone what's happened, someone close to them, usually a friend or even a partner or a family member, the response often is, well, it's just, you know, it's not that big a deal. Or why are you making a fuss? Or what did you do to deserve it? Were you looking at him? What were you wearing? So actually, even what you did do in that circumstance where your options were limited probably will have been helpful in validating her feeling that it wasn't acceptable.
Haven't we been seeing some obvious examples of casual sexism during the Olympics? BBC reporter John Inverdale praised the tennis player Andy Murray for being the first person to win two Olympic medals in tennis. Then Murray noted that Venus and Serena Williams have won four each.
Four each, yes,
and that's
correct.
And then they comment on the attractiveness of female athletes, who's the prettiest gymnast. There was talk about the sexiest ever Olympic opening ceremony, with somebody saying there'll be lots of nearly naked women doing the samba.
That's right, yes. And also we had... somebody commenting that they criticizing a gymnast because they felt that her leotard didn't complement her skin tone, which I would say is an example of sexism and racism. We had the same presenter, John Inverdale, actually, a few days earlier, was presenting a medal for rugby sevens to the men's rugby sevens, or he was presenting during that ceremony, rather. And he said, and of course, this is the first time ever that an Olympic medal has been awarded for this sport, for rugby sevens. Although a couple of days earlier, the women's rugby sevens medals had been awarded. It's quite extraordinary. There was also an American athlete who won a medal, and the Chicago Tribune printed the headline, "Wife of a Bears linesman wins medal." There was another athlete who won a medal, and as the camera panned across into the crowd over to her husband, the presenter said, "And there's the man who's responsible." Yes, it's been really, really eye-opening, I think. And this is not the first time. We saw very similar coverage at the last Olympics, but I'm heartened that at least we're discussing it this time around. There has been a real outpouring. People are starting to notice these smaller instances and put them together. And it's a really good example of the way that women in the public eye are treated as women first and foremost, and then as whatever their profession is, a distant second. We see this as well very clearly in the treatment of female politicians, in the criticisms of Hillary for being too frumpy or showing too much cleavage, she can't win, and criticisms of Hillary's voice being too shrill or too bossy or too demanding, the kind of criticisms that just don't get levied at political men. And it's an enormous double standard, but it's only when you look at all these cases alongside each other that you start to see how much it adds up.
Let's bring Adriana from New Jersey into this conversation. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard Lope. Hi. So my story kind of goes back a couple of years when I was student teaching up in Boston. And in this kind of situation, I had a seventh grader kind of suggest to me that I should perform oral sex on him in front of his friends. So with that shock, I was like, immediately, that's a very kind of problematic place to be in it. And I really had no idea how to handle that. And I was really kind of hurt and bothered by it. You know, eventually I had reported it to the teacher that I was participating with. And later that day, I had called my father to tell him what had happened, because I was really bothered by the situation. And, my father is a fairly progressive person, but when I told him this, the initial reaction that he gave me was a chuckle and a laugh, as if boys will be boys, and, you know, this is kind of just, you know, a ludicrous thing that happens. And, you know, thankfully I was in this point and in this mindset where I was like, why are you laughing? This is not funny. And, you know, thankfully we had a really progressive conversation about, like, why it was not okay, and he realized why his reaction was problematic. But it's still something that kind of shocks me and that I have a problem with today, that we consistently have to justify why we feel offended by something like a seventh grader sexually harassing a full-grown adult, and why that's not ludicrous. Like, it's tiresome to have to explain why that's not funny.
Absolutely. I think that is so true. And it comes down to this complete difference in lived experience, that for many men, the idea of having to experience these things is just so distant from their day-to-day lives that the idea of it is something that they can't even really imagine. So I think that that's a really good example of the how tiring it can be to kind of have to constantly go through those things over and over.
Devon from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hey, thanks for taking my call. To piggyback on what you just said just now, I was dating a woman a while ago, and she frequently sort of explained to me what was happening when she would walk down the street, and it seemed a little, it just seemed crazy to me, because when I was out walking with her, you know, of course, I don't see any of this, so I once just sort of walked behind her for a few blocks, 30 or 40 feet behind, and I was shocked by sort of the just every day. And this was just kind of her trip through the West Village in the middle of the day. And I think they're, in a way, like people like me might be a huge part of the problem, because we sort of just kind of go through blissfully ignorant. I think we need help.
Well,
some way to understand what's happening. And
Laura, what do you suggest that people like Devon can do? People
who are sensitive to the situation.
Well, I mean, I'm really heartened to hear that because I believe very strongly that this is, you know, there's a critical mass of men, a huge number of men who are in that situation. They wouldn't dream of behaving like this themselves, but because they just don't witness it, they don't know it's happening. And in a way, that's why I've written the book. That's why I started this project, because here are 100,000 people's experiences, mostly women's experiences, all in one place where men can go and actually educate themselves and learn about these things and find out what's happening and what the impact is without women to having to go through that emotional work of explaining and justifying it. So, I mean, that's one place that I would direct you straight away to everydaysexism.com or to have a look at the book. But also I think that there is a very, very simple way to educate yourself about this. And it is, if you feel able to and if they feel able to, just to go home tonight and talk to women in your life. Just ask them if they've ever experienced anything like this, and then sit down and probably be completely shocked and saddened for an hour. But it's such a strange thing that women experience this every single day, and many of us never tell anyone about the vast majority of these incidents because we have been trained to think that it's normal.
But Laura, even when women do complain, as we've seen in the Fox News Roger Ailes case, often employers just look the other way, and sometimes the woman is even punished for having complained. We are pretty much out of time, but a reminder that we have a link to your website on our website, and we're going to keep this conversation going on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate. The book is Everyday Sexism, the project that inspired a worldwide movement. It's published by St. Martin's Griffin in the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. And my great thanks to all of you who have called. I'm sorry I couldn't get to more of the calls because we really have opened up a hornet's nest here. Thank you, Laura, so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Natalie Portman has starred in over 25 films since she made her debut in 1994 in Luc Besson's The Professional. She received an Academy Award for Best Actress along with a Golden Globe, BAFTA Award, Screen Actors Guild Award, and Critics' Choice Award for her performance in Darren Aronofsky's Black Swan. But she not only stars in her latest film, A Tale of Love and Darkness, this time she's also written the script and directed. It is based on Amos Oz's international best-selling autobiographical novel of the same name about growing up in Jerusalem in the years before and immediately after Israeli statehood. And it opens tomorrow at the Landmark Sunshine Cinema and brings Natalie Portman to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I should have mentioned that it was also the closing night film at the New York Film Festival last fall. A Tale of Love and Darkness was written by Oz in 2004, and it's not only Israel's all-time best-selling novel, but also it's been an international bestseller, translated even into Kurdish, I understand. What do you think it is that gave it so much appeal?
Well, it's funny that you say that you ask that, because Amos Oz talks about it a lot, so I can steal his answer. Because he says that when he wrote it, he thought it would be interesting only to his block from his particular area of Jerusalem and people who were maybe alive at that time, and then it became this sort of runaway international bestseller. And he thinks it's because of this sort of universality of the immigrant's story of, you know, having an idealized version of the place you're going to, and then when you get there, of course, it doesn't live up to the expectations.
And that was in his case, and in the case of your family and many mm-hmm. others. The Ashkenazic Jews from Europe. Did the same thing apply to the Sephardic Jews who came from the Middle East? And
absolutely. It was very...
They all had this fantasy of the pioneer. You actually have a character, the pioneer, in your film, a fantasy character.
Yeah, I think that maybe the expectations were different because they were obviously formed from different cultures and different traditions. And I'm obviously, as someone who's Ashkenazi, I don't necessarily have all the sort of family mythology that would inform me about the Sephardic expectations. But I do know from friends and everything that they obviously left also as refugees later on, more in the 50s, after statehood, when the laws that had been relatively lax with Jews in Arab countries suddenly started getting more restrictive. And when they got to Israel, then they were treated as second-class citizens. There was a lot of racism against them, and they were put into refugee camps, and many people who came from very well-off families were all of a sudden living in tents.
Well, what was the pioneer fantasy?
Well, the pioneer fantasy, I think, persists even today.
But there are no kibbutzim anymore.
There aren't today. Well, there are, but they're mainly privatized. There are still a few that are operating as socialist sort of utopian communities. But I think that there's a dichotomy that Oz talks about a lot, that's like the old Jew and the new Jew, and how the new Israeli Jew is like the manly man who can fight and is not the sort of like, you know, nebbishy European stereotype that we had believed ourselves maybe of, you know, the pale, weak Jew who's going to be bullied reading his books inside. And now there's this new Israeli Jew who's tall and muscled and bronzed and can fight and, you know, and cares more about poetry and music and you know.
But named after a cactus.
Right, exactly. That is not indigenous to Israel either. Is indigenous to Mexico and was brought to Israel. So that's also funny.
In a piece that was featured in the New York Times T-Style magazine, you told Jonathan Safran Foer that in many ways adapting Oz's book was an obvious choice for your first film. Why?
Well, because it's so close to my own family history, what his parents and my grandparents were in a sort of similar generation circle. You know, my grandparents were more leftist than his parents were quite right, actually. But, you know, the stories I heard of what it was like to come from Europe, from relative, you know, comforts of life, but of course escaping this awful tragedy, then coming and being sort of in this collective trauma of all of these sort of orphans trying to build a new state, was a kind of psychology that I had heard about my whole life.
Although you were born in Israel, your family moved to the United States when you were three. So how much time have you spent in Israel over the years? Because this is a film that's all in Hebrew, and the script is in Hebrew, and you say that language is definitely a character in the movie.
Yes, I really only went once or twice a year after I moved back at age three. So I am very much a foreigner in Israel.
How's your accent?
My accent was not very good. I worked with Netta Riskin, who's an actress in the film and also coached me for my dialect for 2 months before. So she improved my accent so that I still sound foreign to an Israeli, but not American.
But that's okay, because you're playing a character in this film.
Exactly.
Who's from Poland.
Right.
But on top of directing and writing this this screenplay, you are also playing the leading role in it. Did you ever wonder why you'd chosen such a difficult project for your first feature film?
You know, I didn't really think of it as difficult or scary while I was doing it, because I think if I had, I wouldn't have done it. I'm not someone who's a very risky, risk-taker personality.
I mean, playing a ballerina wasn't a risk-taking?
But I had the same thing where, like, in retrospect, it was totally crazy to think I could pull it off. But at the moment, I only was interested in it and believed I could do it. And that allowed me, I think, the sort of oblivion to the extremity of what I was taking on helped me do it.
We're talking about A Tale of Love and Darkness, which opens at the Landmark Sunshine Cinema tomorrow, with Natalie Portman, who not only wrote and directed but also stars in the film. And you said that you've learned that, I'm quoting, if you set something in Israel, even if it's fundamentally a story of love between a boy and his mother, it is brave, and that you often wish that you were from somewhere inoffensive to anyone, neutral, unproblematic, like Finland. What kinds of problems did you run into?
Not problems. It's just being born in Israel and having an Israeli passport, you say that, and the first thing people ask you is, you know, your opinions on the Mideast conflict and, you know, what you think can be done. And
it, so everybody's an expert?
Yeah, and it's a burden, and people have opinions immediately when you open your mouth, and some people hate you or love you because of where you're from, and it's a lot to carry with you everywhere. I appreciate it now because I feel like it's so formative for my identity and made me think about things empathetically in a way that I never would have had to consider otherwise. But I do wonder all the time what it's like to just walk in a room and not have your nationality be, you know, an issue.
What got you think about directing now? Have you wanted to do this for a while?
I have wanted to do it for a while. You know, you can only bemoan the fact that there are so few female directors for long enough as a woman before you say, okay, well, I'm going to do it, because I do have a vision for what I want to make and the stories I want to tell.
You have done a couple of short films.
I did make some short films, and I've been working on other films for 25 years now, and I've been lucky enough to have this sort of informal film school that I've lived through.
But you said that you couldn't get financing unless you agreed to play Fania.
Yes.
The primary characters are, Fania, the mother, the 10-year-old Amos, the same name as the author, mm-hmm. even though this is a novel, and the father, Arya. Was that his father's name as well?
Yes, yes.
And you describe the story as about the birth of a writer that happens because of a void his mother leaves that he has to fill with words and stories. In the movie, he says at one point he doesn't want to become a writer.
Yeah.
He wants to become a farmer.
Or a dog poisoner, he says, because feelings disgust him, which I think as a child and being in being put in such an emotional position because his mother is obviously really struggling with life, that he just wants to get as far from feelings as possible as a kid, but he's inevitably a writer.
Well, she seems to be training him to be a writer, and his father is also a writer, if not a successful writer, or rather yes. academic writer.
Absolutely. They definitely put him through some sort of genius school at home, just trying to, you know, foster a writer, and it certainly happened.
In an early scene, we see Amos's preference for a two-state solution when the young Amos is brought by his uncle to a party at a friendly Palestinian neighbor's, and he very sincerely tells this young Arab girl that he meets in the back garden that there's room for two people in this land. And then something very unfortunate happens that shows that it's not going to be so easy.
Yeah, he describes it in the book, which is so charming, which is a feeling that he feels like he has to be an ambassador for his people, you know, just as a kid going and talking to another kid. And that's sort of the familiar feeling of, you know, what it is to walk into a room and be an Israeli. And I'm sure that a Palestinian might have similar feelings, that you walk in and you immediately feel that you bear this responsibility to represent your entire people in a positive way.
But even at the beginning, when the state was being proposed, there was disagreement over what it should be like. Martin Buber thought it should just be a state in which there was no one homeland. Others said it had to be a Jewish homeland.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's no one Zionism. There were hundreds of different Zionisms, and I don't think any of them have been completely realized, of course.
Did many people feel at the time that two persecuted people should be teaming up to fight against their colonial oppressor, in this case, Great Britain, although instead they wound up fighting each other?
Well, I think that Oz's, one of his real talents as a peace leader, because in addition to being a great novelist, he of course is one of the founders of the Peace Now movement and a great, great spokesman for two-state solution. And one of his assessments, which I included in the film, which is from the book, is where he talks about how both Israel, both the Jews and the Arabs are victims of Europe, and that they're sort of children of the same abusive father, and that instead of seeing each other as siblings of the same abusive father, they look at each other as the new abusive father, the new colonialists or the new Nazis. And I think it's really accurate to sort of see the nations as individuals.
Didn't you get a degree in psychology from Harvard?
Yes, I did.
Now, why didn't you go to get a degree in acting or theater?
It's a good question.
You began in theater? You played Anne Frank?
Yes, when I was 16.
11? Oh.
Yeah. I started in film and then I did when I was 11 in The Professional, and then did Anne Frank. I think I was really shy about doing anything relating to acting in school because it felt in some way like I shouldn't be, because I had the great luck to be doing it professionally. And so then people who were actually just starting or training or whatever to be going to school with someone who was working professionally already somehow felt funny to me.
Meanwhile, you said that directing, you were prepared for directing to some degree by becoming a mother.
Yes.
You have to be a mother to all the actors.
Well, not even a mother. I feel like a parent, because I feel like I'm sure fathers experience a similar thing. But, you know, your job as a director, you work with all these people and all of them are incredibly talented. And you just have to make the environment right that their talent can best be expressed. And that felt very parental to me.
You have a whole bunch of other things coming out. Is Terrence Malick's film Night of Cups and also Gavin O'Connor's Jane Got a Gun?
Those came out, last year, yes.
Yeah, but then you have other things. What's
yes.
coming out now?
You're
producing Eating Animals.
Yes. I'm producing Eating Animals, which is a documentary of Jonathan Safran Foer's nonfiction book about sort of the whole factory farming and mass production of animal foods. And I have a few films that I acted in that are going to be coming out, including Jackie and Planetarium, that'll be at Venice and Toronto Film Festivals.
And then you function as an ambassador for a couple of organizations. So you keep a lot on your plate?
I do, but I also like to stare at the wall sometimes.
Well, you'll be doing a question and answer this Friday. That's tomorrow at the Landmark Sunshine, following the 7 o'clock screening of A Tale of Love and Darkness. And my great thanks to Natalie Portman for coming on our show today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.